Well, is there anyone here who supports the Parramatta Eels? That's a little bit unfortunate, I think. I was hoping there'd be no one here who supports the Eels because I've got some nasty things to say about them. Anyway, you know how the Eels, they had a bad start to the season, didn't they? They had a few losses, they weren't looking too good, and at the early part of the season, there are a number of people who were saying the writing is on the wall for the Parramatta Eels. Now, when you think of the phrase, the writing is on the wall, what do you normally think about? Hopefully, when you think about the writing on the wall, you don't think about graffiti. And hopefully, when we look around the place here, we don't see any writing on the wall either. I can't see any, can you? It's probably a good thing. Anyway, when we think about the writing on the wall, what do we normally think of? It's a particular English expression, right? You've heard of it before? But the question is, what does this expression mean? Any thoughts? What does it mean to say that the writing is on the wall? You're a goner? You're a goner. What does it mean that you're a goner? You're done. Things aren't looking good, right? So if the writing's on the wall, it's a sign, something that's happened, which is telling you that the future doesn't look too good. So when we think about the writing being on the wall, it's basically an omen of impending doom or misfortune. And it's interesting because this expression, the writing being on the wall, actually comes from the passage that we're looking at today. So every time you hear people talking about the writing being on the wall, then it's really thanks to Daniel 5 that we have this concept. Now, in order to understand a little bit more about what was actually involved when the writing was on the wall originally, historically, then we have to know the story of what happened to King Belshazzar in Daniel 5. But in order to do that, it's good to set the scene in history. Now, we've been looking at King Nebuchadnezzar so far. King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. He's been the topic of the previous four chapters. Now, he was king until 562 BC. He was then followed by his son, Armel-Marduk, who is known as Evil Merodach. Sounds like a good name, doesn't it, one? Evil Merodach in the Bible. Now, Evil Merodach, he reigned for about 2 years before Neri-Glissa, who was Nebuchadnezzar's son-in-law, he assassinated Evil Merodach in order to take power. Now, Neri-Glissa, he was eventually succeeded by his son, Labashi-Marduk, but he was king for about 9 months or so before Nabonidus, who may have been another son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar, came to the throne. And the speculation is that he also became king by way of conspiracy. Now, none of those kings following Nebuchadnezzar are mentioned as such in the book of Daniel, but Nabonidus is significant as being the father of Belshazzar. And we'll be thinking about Belshazzar today. Belshazzar's mentioned in chapter 5 and also in chapters 7 and 8 of the book of Daniel. Now, the strange thing about Belshazzar was that he was co-regent with his father. So his father's the king, but he also functioned as a king as well. And the story goes that Nabonidus, because he favoured the worship of a moon god, who wasn't the traditional Babylonian sun god, well, he found it easier to live away from the capital city. So he didn't live in Babylon, but he left his son Belshazzar to reign in Babylon. And it's interesting that the traditional Babylonian sun god, Marduk, was also known as Bel. And we get Bel in the name Belshazzar. So Bel was really just a title, means Lord, a title which was applied to Marduk. So we see that Belshazzar, he's got a good name. He's got a kind of Marduk name. So it's appropriate for him to be there in Babylon, whereas his father, who is viewed as a bit of a heretic, he's in another city of the empire. Now, apart from the name Belshazzar, we should also keep in mind that King Belshazzar's name is very similar to the Babylonian name which King Nebuchadnezzar had given to Daniel. Right? Daniel was called Belteshazzar, and here we have King Belshazzar. They're almost identical. Now, having a look at our chapter, we see that one day Belshazzar held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles. And as you can see from the number of nobles present, it was a large and important feast. Now, reconstructing something of the history back at that time, we know that this feast took place on the day that Babylon was defeated by the Persians in 539 BC. So this great feast, it could have been something a bit like a Last Supper. There's probably not much hope for the kingdom. So they decide to maybe end it all in a nice way. We'll get everyone together, we'll have this big feast, we'll be able to gather all of the gods of the kingdom there, all of the idols, and we'll pray to them, and we hope that we'll be saved. But if we're not saved, then at least we'll go out in a party style. We'll sort of drown our sorrows if things don't go well. So literally, they hadn't seen the writing on the wall yet, okay? But they had seen how the Babylonian army had been defeated in a city not far away by the Persians. So things weren't looking good. The news had come of defeat. So to help drown their sorrows, there was lots of wine. And it seems that Belshazzar himself had imbibed a fair bit too. Under the influence of the alcohol, Belshazzar came up with a great party idea. Now, normally if you're drunk, any ideas that you come up with are probably not good ones, right? And I think something of this applies to Belshazzar too. His idea was, hey, why don't we use the gold and silver drinking vessels, the goblets that Nebuchadnezzar had captured from the temple in Jerusalem? Sounds like a good idea, let's do it. Well, it seemed like a good idea to Belshazzar at the time. It might have made the party guests feel good, something a bit different, something a bit new, a bit of gold and silver there. But it was a bad move as far as God was concerned. These were God's drinking vessels from his temple in Jerusalem. But here we have Belshazzar and his nobles, along with Belshazzar's wives and concubines, using God's holy objects to get drunk with. Not only that, but we're told in verse 4 that as they were getting drunk, they were worshipping gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood and stone. You know, every possible kind of idol. It was like they were all there. And they're probably all there in order for them to be prayed to, that somehow they would save Babylon from Persia. It was a vain hope that they had in these gods of stone and wood, that somehow they might be saved from the oncoming Persian army. But as they were doing this, as they were drinking, as they were thinking about the uncertain future, right at that very moment, fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote in front of the lampstand on the plaster on the wall of the palace of the king. Now, when Belshazzar saw this, he was terrified. His drunken smirk changed to fear. So much so that, and this is sort of skipped over in our Bible translation here, it just sort of says his legs went weak, but it actually seems like he lost control of his bowels and dirtied his pants. And in addition, his knees knocked together from trembling. Now, with all this happening, he was flabbergasted, he was terrified, and he shouted out for the wise men to come and to read the writing, to explain its meaning. And he even promised that whoever could read and interpret the writing would be dressed in a purple robe of royalty there, and given a gold chain to wear around his neck, and would be given a third of the kingdom of Babylon to rule. Now, this idea of the third of the kingdom probably comes from the fact that Belshazzar was co-regent with his father Nabonidus. So, if Nabonidus is number one, Belshazzar is number two, that means the best position that Belshazzar could give is basically position number three. So, it's quite a reward which is offered here. But despite this promise of a rich reward, none of the wise men of Babylon could read the writing or solve its meaning. As a result of this impasse, the colour of Belshazzar's face turned even more pale than previously, and all of his guests there, all of the nobles, they were totally perplexed. They didn't know what was going on. And it's at this point that the queen, who is probably historically the queen mother, so she's probably the mother of Belshazzar, having seen the situation unfold, she came into the banquet hall and told the king not to be afraid. She then reminded the king of a special wise man that had helped his father, or probably more accurately his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. The queen described this man as someone who had the spirit of the holy gods in him. From their perspective, it was just the spirit of the holy gods. But we know that it was actually the spirit of the one true holy God who had really inspired Daniel in the wisdom that he had. But because of the fact that he had God's spirit in him, Daniel was famous in Babylon for his, as the Queen Mother says, for his illumination, for his insight and wisdom, which was like the wisdom of the gods. Because of his God-given wisdom, Daniel was appointed by Nebuchadnezzar to be the chief wise man in all of Babylon. And because of his preeminent spirit and knowledge and insight, Daniel was able to interpret dreams, this is according to the Queen Mother here, and also to loosen knots, which is interesting. Loosen knots, which means on the surface to solve problems, right? But it's also, ironically, exactly what had happened to Belshazzar's loins after he saw the writing on the wall. In other words, there's a kind of implication here. If only Belshazzar had been seeking the wisdom of Daniel all along, then he could have spared his underwear from that accident. Now, in another quite ironic moment, the queen mentioned how Daniel had been named Belteshazzar by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, as I said before, Daniel's Babylonian name was almost identical to Belshazzar. Belteshazzar and Belshazzar, almost identical. But it's interesting that here we see the queen, she mentions Belteshazzar, but when she talks about Daniel, she just uses the name Daniel. Daniel's name means God is my judge. His Babylonian name meant may Belet protect the king. Now Belet was the wife of Bel, Marduk, the chief Babylonian god. So Belshazzar means may Bel protect the king. But we see here the fact that Daniel was called Daniel and not Belteshazzar on the part of the queen mother is basically a sign that that attempt on the part of the Babylonians to re-educate Daniel, to give him a new name, a new identity. At the end of his life, we see that he was called Daniel, not Belteshazzar. This Babylonian re-education attempt had failed. And it's also a sign that the one true God, the God who is the judge, he was about to act in judgment upon Belshazzar. Now here's Belshazzar hoping that Marduk's going to save him. No, that's not going to happen. Rather, the God of Daniel, the God who is my judge, the God who is Belshazzar's judge, he is the one who is about to act. Anyway, Belshazzar, he listened to his mum and called for Daniel. You notice that there? He called not for Belteshazzar, But exactly like the queen, he addressed Daniel as Daniel. Now, Daniel, by this stage, he's an old man. He's probably around about 80 years old. So that's getting on. But the king gave to him the same promise that he had given to the other wise men. If you're able to read the writing and to explain its meaning, then you will receive the third highest position in all of the Babylonian Empire. Well, let's have a look at Daniel's response. Now, first of all, Daniel, he refused the offer of the reward. He refused the gifts. He basically said, "You keep them. I'm not interested in that. You either keep them or you give them to someone else." We can see from this that Daniel wasn't in this for his own personal gain. And I guess, furthermore, if you think about it, if Daniel knew that the Babylonian kingdom was about to fall, then those rewards, even though they sound good, they're not going to really last for too long. Now, the second thing that Daniel did was to take the king to task for not learning the lesson of humility from his father Nebuchadnezzar. And we see this very clearly in verses 18 through to 23. Daniel basically says, "The Most High God, he gave the kingdom and greatness and honor and majesty to your father Nebuchadnezzar. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all of the peoples, nations and languages, they trembled and feared before him. Whoever he wanted to kill, well, he killed them. Whoever he wanted to let live, well, he spared them. Whoever he wanted to humble and to degradate, well, he did what he wanted." In other words, Nebuchadnezzar, he had supreme power, or at least it seemed that way. But as soon as his heart became arrogant and his spirit grew presumptuous, what happened? Well, Daniel says he was deposed from his royal throne, and the honour that he had as king was stripped from him. He was chased away from human society, and his heart was like the heart of an animal. And he lived out with the wild donkeys. He ate grass like an ox, and his body was washed by the dew of heaven, until he recognized that the Most High God has authority over the kingdom of men and establishes it over whomever he desires. You see what Daniel's saying here? He's referring, of course, to Nebuchadnezzar's mental illness. Remember the 7 years that we looked at previously? The 7 years when he wandered out in the fields, eating grass like an ox. Now, this was an illness sent by God to teach Nebuchadnezzar about the need for humility in the light of God's sovereignty. Nebuchadnezzar had learned the lesson of the futility of pride and the need for humility before God. But Belshazzar had ignored this lesson. This is what Daniel says. "But you," you know, all of that happened to Nebuchadnezzar, "but you, his son, you have not humbled your heart even though you knew about all of this. By drinking from the drinking vessels from the Lord's temple, you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven." You're opposing the Lord of heaven. Do you think you're going to get away with it? "You've also engaged in idolatry. You've praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood and stone. Gods which, because they're idols, do not see and do not hear and do not know anything. But the God, the true God, who holds your very breath in his hands and who controls all of your ways, him you have not glorified." You can see Daniel's talking fairly strongly here to King Belshazzar. What do we see? We see arrogance and idolatry on the part of Belshazzar. Don't think that you can treat God with contempt and get away with it. It's simply stupid to put anything above God in your life. Pride is delusional, and so is worshipping anything else other than the one true God. And friends, this is something that applies to us, not just to King Belshazzar. We so easily turn from the God who holds our very life in his hands to worthless idols. And there's a lesson here for every single human being, including us. We all need to flee from pride and to flee from idolatry. Now this brings us to the writing on the wall. Now it was a big mystery for Belshazzar and the other wise men, but it's actually quite simple in the end once it's been deciphered. Seems that it was written in Aramaic, because Mene Mene Tekel Upharsin is Aramaic. Or as it's translated into English, it's Minor Minor Shekel and Half Shekel. Now if you add all of that up, they would have been like weights, which they would have used for money. A minor, minor shekel and a half shekel, it all adds up to 1.2 kilos of precious metal. And back then they probably used silver. So 1.2 kilos of silver, today that's the equivalent of around about $100,000. 1 gram of silver these days is worth almost exactly $1. But what does this mean? Well, this is where it gets interesting. A minor sounds like the Aramaic word for number. So, mene mene means God has numbered. He's numbered your kingdom. And it's finished. It's like he's numbered the days and he's come to the end of the days, so your kingdom's finished. And tekel, which is related to the Hebrew word shekel, you can see how they sort of sound a bit similar there, tekel and shekel. The word tekel is the Aramaic word for weigh. So tekel basically means weighed. This means that Belshazzar had been weighed in God's scales of justice and been found to be lacking. It's like he's a dud. He's not the full quid. He's not the full expected value. And finally, we've got Peres. Now this word peres, or farsin, parsin, has a double meaning. It means half a shekel, but it also sounds like the Aramaic word for broken in two, or divided. So that's probably the idea. A shekel, when you break it up into two, when you divide it into two, it becomes half a shekel. The meaning of being divided is also potentially negative when that's applied to a kingdom. At the same time, the word Peres sounds like the Aramaic word for Persia, which was Paras. So you've got a kind of double play on words here. The meaning? Well, it means your kingdom has been divided. That's the first Peres. And given over to the Medes and Persians, the second Peres. So all in all, the writing on the wall was a word of judgment. The words proclaimed that Belshazzar had been weighed in the balance, found deficient, and as a result of this, his kingdom was going to fall to the enemy, to the Medes and Persians. The writing on the wall was a word of judgment, an omen proclaiming Babylon's impending doom. And that's where we get the saying, the writing on the wall today, from this incident. Well, we're not told how Belshazzar responded to the negative content of the writing on the wall. No, after all, it doesn't sound very good. All we get to see, really, is that Belshazzar, well, he kept his word. Daniel was honoured by being made ruler over the third part of the empire. But significantly, it wasn't just Belshazzar keeping his word. God kept his word too. That very night, the king, Belshazzar, the ruler of Babylon, he was killed as the Persians took hold of the city. Well, what then are we to learn from the writing on the wall? Well, hopefully you can all see how this story is in the Bible as a warning. It's here for us to read and to study and to reflect upon in order to make sure that we're not like Belshazzar, arrogant and idolatrous. So, in the light of that, the question for each one of us here today is, have we learnt this lesson yet? Have we learnt the lesson that was taught to King Nebuchadnezzar? He learnt that lesson, he took it on board, but here we see his grandson not listening to that. I hope that each one of us here today will understand that God is number one. Make sure that you're very clear about that fact. And make sure that nothing gets in the way of worshipping God as he has revealed himself through Jesus. He needs to be number one in your life. Make sure that you understand this. Or otherwise, the writing will be there on the wall also for you. The lesson, just to be crystal clear about it, the lesson is that the Most High God is great. He is the greatest being in all the universe. Therefore, we are to worship him and him alone. Let's humble ourselves before the Lord.